Here's a riddle. What does the craft of writing fiction have to do with mystery, magic, and puzzles? Author and creative writing professor Peter Turchi sets out to answer exactly that question in his latest book, Amuse and Amaze. The book travels through the minds of writers, artists, puzzle makers, and magicians. Peter Turchi is the author of 6 books and a writing professor at the University of Houston. He's going to be reading from Amuse and Amaze at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro tonight at 7 o'clock, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow, and Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville on Saturday. But he is here on The State of Things Now. Peter Turchi, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Tell us about this. Puzzles and riddles and all of this is a frame and a way of getting at writing. What's the connection?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, a piece of writing is designed and it's meant to lead somebody somewhere. It's not only fiction. It's certainly true of poetry and plays and essays. I argue in the book that it'd be true of somebody writing a letter trying to get a raise at work. You have something you want to achieve. You have an end. You have certain information you need to provide. You have to decide what order to provide it in and who you're talking to and how to be successful at that. And so it's really about the design of the parts of any piece of writing.
As I read your book, I remembered something that my mother always says, and she still says it, life is a mystery to be lived and not a riddle to be solved.
Well, I wish I'd had that quotation to cite. I wish your mom could be in the book. I refer to Chekhov, but we hear about Chekhov a lot more in writing classes than your mother. I do think it's true, though. The work we most enjoy, whether it's a poem or a story or a novel, the work we most enjoy often leaves us in something like a state of wonder. I think the work that explains itself perfectly. I mean, I know a lot of people, for instance, enjoy mystery novels, of course. But the mystery novel that completely resolves, where every question is answered by the end, is not a book we're likely to reread. We might read something else by the same writer, but we probably won't go back to that book and work our way through it again. Whereas I know people who read Pride and Prejudice every year. People go back to certain novels that they've loved and they return to them because there are still things that they imagine about those worlds, or there's still questions those books raise for them that can't be resolved, and so they return to them.
And it seems to me there are 2 issues here that could explain that, why the well-wrapped up, the thoroughly wrapped up mystery is not interesting the second time. Number one, well, I know all the answers, so why go back? But number two, in the writing of that book, you could imagine the author had to kind of rework the story in order to have a wrap-upable piece, right? I mean, the fact is, the piece became too tiny because of the author's need to keep control over all the facts.
Absolutely. I quote Raymond Chandler over a couple of pages in this book because Raymond Chandler got so irritated with what became called the classic mystery. And he actually said these were not interesting mysteries and they weren't literature because everybody behaved in a way that they would never act in life. And he said, if you look, I mean, referring back to the difficulties we were just hearing about prisoners, he said, if you look at the messiness of life, there are not easy answers. And so he wanted a mystery novel that acknowledged that the world is often more complicated than those novels would allow.
Well, not only does it make bad literature, but it makes bad social policy. In our first segment, we talked about the continuum that is gender in the real world, in the natural world everywhere. And we've broken it into this binary that has created so much difficulty for people.
One of the chapters in the book is about a character. It's called 7 Clever Pieces. So the puzzle I refer to most in that is that I start with jigsaws, then I talk about tangrams, that game where you use 7 pieces to try to assemble different shapes. And I talk about biography and the fact that you can go to, say, Monticello at the bookstore and you can find a biography of Thomas Jefferson, the architect, Thomas Jefferson, the inventor, Thomas Jefferson, the statesman. And there's plenty to write about all of those things. But we know, in fact, Thomas Jefferson was a very complicated individual, good at some things. He had weaknesses in other areas. And the true biography of the man that recognizes that is a much more interesting book.
Yeah, and then we have to come to terms with Thomas Jefferson, the slaveholder. And that has to be part of the American story. And so we have to tell it all.
Right. And to only see him as that, I mean, to say, well, we'll ignore everything else because he had this one, you know, significant blindness,
right,
would be to lose out on the fact that we are all complicated people.
Right.
And if we find the worst thing about each of us, we will, of course, write everybody off as a useful source of information or ideas.
You point to The Great Gatsby as the book that does this. And of course, it's considered the great American novel with so many unanswered questions, right?
Right. And it's interesting. That book, I think, to some extent, transcended Fitzgerald's understanding of Gatsby. And one of the very earliest copies that he signed, he apologized for the fact that maybe he hadn't gotten Gatsby right. But if you read an earlier draft of it, and I quote a few lines from it in the book, the draft that was published at Tremolchio a couple of years ago, Gatsby actually says things like, well, I guess I'm just a mystery. I guess that's why people make things up about me. I guess that's why I make things up myself. And it's just awful. I mean, just really dreadful. And he went back and cut that out. And the character is mysterious as opposed to talking about being mysterious.
The cover of this book has a picture of a face that viewed one way as a man with a beard and a mustache, viewed the other upside down as a woman with lipstick. Tell us about the story of that picture.
Well, the story of that picture is that we had a different cover entirely for about 2 months. It was of a maze, and words appeared out of the maze. And we were all kind of half satisfied with it, and sometimes that's as good as it gets. And so we sent it off to the printer, but the distributor said, oh no, that just won't do. And the designer came back with this kind of novelty image. It looks like the kind of image that would be packaged with a cheap trick, you know, like the ice cube with a fly in it that you'd get, you know, at some novelty store. And it's kind of funny and strange and kind of, I don't know, retro in some way. And just the fact that it makes you stop for a second and, you know, think about what you're seeing kind of fits with the title, which is five words, A Muse and a Maze, which is meant to recognize the muse being that source of inspiration or mystery or the subconscious, and the maze being the rational mind. And if the use of those words slows you down a little bit too and makes you think about the language, well, that's a good thing.
We've talked about this as a kind of metaphor, puzzles and mystery as metaphor for the creative process. But you point to particular puzzles and riddles and that can actually help a writer. I mean, tell us about that, how we use these.
Well, there are puzzles throughout the book more or less to demonstrate the points. I mean, I'm not sure that doing Sudoku will necessarily make you a better writer, although I'd love to think so since I've spent some time doing so. But I do think that it can be possible if you're faced with what feels like an abstract task of improving a piece of writing to be able to stand back from it and to think about the problems you're trying to solve and to try to identify those and approach those rationally, knowing that something, as I've said before, will need to transcend that. But to recognize those tasks is very helpful. And so the book is actually about quite practical things like the development of complex characters, the way a story transcends plot, the way characters can be described to be as complex as the people that we know in life, those sorts of things.
I'm talking with author Peter Turchi today on The State of Things. His latest book is A Muse and a Maze, which you could hear as A Muse and a Maze, but in fact he's got, as he says, five words in there if you consider the and in the conjunction. So here's the thing. The other side of this is people who write badly and then say, well, I wanted to leave it to the reader's imagination.
Yes.
And really what they did was write a bad book.
Well, right, or it's vague or abstract in some way. No, you see that a lot in if you teach writing, you see it in, sometimes in high school students and undergraduates, not to pick on the young. I'm sure I did the exact same thing myself.
When you were young.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's been a while. But the important thing is to recognize for yourself if you're really kind of withholding information because you don't know it, because you don't understand it yourself, or because you're withholding things because you're trying to create tension or suspense for the reader. It's a tricky issue. You have to be honest with yourself. And sometimes we do pull up short and just hope things are good enough. And then you have to be a good enough editor of your own work to say, well, you know, somebody else might not notice that, but I do. Mm-hmm. So I need to go back and try to be clear.
You talk about the artist Charles Ritchie.
Yes.
Tell us about him and how that figures into all of this.
Charlie was somebody I met the first and only time I've been to an artist colony. He's a print curator at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and he's also quite a wonderful artist. And I was struck by his practice. Charlie, at that time, had for decades only made images about the size of a postcard, only in black and white, with no people or animals in them. And they were images only of things he could see through the windows of his house in suburban D.C. And I was struck by how narrowly defined his work seemed to be. But he had decided that his project would be to observe the world around him as carefully as he could. And that meant eliminating a lot of other elements. And it reminded me of the naturalist E.O. Wilson, who made his career studying fire ants. And he had decided that to study one thing carefully would make a career for him, which it did for a long time. And of course, he's branched out since then. But I was interested in how intently Charlie looked at his work, and it made me think about how sometimes writers become self-conscious about the fact that they'll repeat themselves in certain ways. They'll return, I don't know, to a certain place as a setting, or to certain kinds of people, or to a certain dynamic in a book, a father and son relationship. And sometimes writers feel like they need to change because they're doing something similar. But in fact, recognizing those obsessions can be helpful to us, I think. And you can recognize the things that are most meaningful to you and so explore them more completely. And that was an important lesson I learned from Charlie. And then I referenced some other aspects of his work in the book as well.
It's all very helpful and interesting. Peter, always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Peter Turchi, a professor of English at the University of Houston and the author of Amuse and Amaze, Writing as Puzzle, Mystery, and Magic. Going to be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro tonight, 7 o'clock. Then tomorrow, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, and then Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville on Saturday. And if you missed that, go to our website, stateofthings.org. We've got it all right there. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. WUNC's news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.